In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. If you're going to have a series, or rather a service, about joy during Advent, then obviously the first thing you think of is how we began with the prelude of today's worship, From Joy to the World. Alternatively, you might also think of Joyful, Joyful, We Adore Thee, which owes its melody to none other than Beethoven from his Ode to Joy. We could get Craig Verma up here to sing it in the original German. And you think of joy in that way, exuberant, jubilant, triumphant. But if you've been listening closely and leaning in, you've noticed that in a service about joy, the choices that we have made here, whether it comes to readings or to music or to prayer, have been on a different note, all about joy, but we'll just say a little bit more subdued, a little more solemn, and that's on purpose. We began with a moment of Edward VI reckoning with his own mortality at Christmas, staring at his daughter who would soon be queen in the wake of his death. Because as the other hymn goes, O tidings of comfort and joy. Those two things are not two things. I might suggest to you that they are one. That the joy is about comfort. We've chosen those songs and elected to make those prayers and include those texts, not because we find joy to be anything less than exuberant, not because we find joy to be unimpressive or not out to make a mark or a difference in us. It is because there's plenty of sorrow to go around in this room and in our world. And here's the question. Is there such a thing as joy through tears? And the argument that we are making today is, absolutely. Joy may certainly coexist and buoy us up in our sorrow. And that's why we would say that there is a joy that is above. Even before we define what joy is, if our signal call from Paul during Advent is that if you've been raised with Christ, seek the things that are above, set your minds on things that are above, not on things that are on the earth, then that must include joy. What is that joy above? That's our question. That's our burden, to which we've given hints along the way. This sermon is going to culminate in a real-time expression and application of what it means to bring your sorrow before his joy. And we will make room for that as long as we need to. But in this sermon, we want to ask two questions about joy by listening to two texts in conversation, Jesus and his brother James. And listening to them together, we're going to consider joy under two headings. What is this joy above in summary? And what is this joy above in practice? If there is a joy above, what is it? And what does it look like? I wonder if you're able to stand. We're going to read first from John 16 and then James chapter 1. Beginning in John 16, starting in verse 16. A little while, and you will see me no longer. And again, a little while, and you will see me. So some of his disciples said to one another, What is this that he says to us? A little while, and you will not see me. And again, a little while, and you will see me. And because I'm going to the Father? So they were saying, what does he mean by a little while? We don't know what he's talking about. Jesus knew that they wanted to ask him. So he said to them, is this what you're asking yourselves? What I meant by saying, a little while, and you will not see me. And again, a little while, and you will see me. Truly, truly, I say to you, you will weep and lament, but the world will rejoice. You will be sorrowful, but your sorrow will turn to joy. When a woman is giving birth, she has sorrow because her hour has come. But when she has delivered the baby, she no longer remembers the anguish for a joy that a human being has been born into the world. So also, you have sorrow now, but I will see you again, and your hearts will rejoice, and no one will take your joy from you. In that day you will ask nothing of me. Truly, truly, I say to you, whatever you ask of the Father in my name, he will give it to you. Until now you've asked nothing in my name. Ask, and you will receive, that your joy may be full. And then in James chapter 1, count it all joy, my brothers, when you meet trials of various kinds, for you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness. And let steadfastness have its full effect, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. You may have a seat. If I want to talk about joy, I need first to make two distinctions. To set joy, the joy that is above, distinctive from things that we might confuse it with. One of which is happiness. If I say to you, what is joy? Give me a definition. I would expect that most of you, or many of us, forgive me, might offer something that is that which lifts your spirits, that puts a smile on your face, that puts a spring in your step. That's joy. And that's not wrong, but in every version of what we might say is your definition of joy, it's more like happiness, because happiness is always tethered. It is tethered to your moment. It is tethered to your circumstances. It is tethered to your outlook. That's happiness. Joy is different. It shares some of those same characteristics. It is not the same. And you know that. If anything, you might get help in understanding the difference between joy and happiness by going outside and just staring at a tree, of all things. A tree, the part you see, what's above ground, that you might liken to happiness. When the sun is shining, when the winds are calm, and the leaves are receiving their nourishment from the sun to nourish the tree, that is a picture of happiness, because everything is controllable, everything is sedate, everything is without issue. But go beneath the surface, and there you see something that is different. You find the roots. And the roots are there not just to nourish the tree from underground, to pull the nitrogen and the water and all of the oxygen and all of those nourishing things that help the tree to survive. Those roots anchor. That's the difference between joy and happiness. Everything that is above ground, when the sun is shining, that's a version of happiness. But regardless of what is happening above ground, joy is what anchors you into this world, that anchors you into your life, that allows you not just to survive, but to fulfill the very purpose for which you exist. That's the definition of joy as distinct from happiness. But if Paul was making a distinction in there in Colossians 3 about seek the things that are above, not the things that are on the earth, and what is the joy that is above? What's an earthly source or substance or version of joy? And one I can think about that's perhaps the most credible, you may not think about it very often, but it is true of what's a philosophy that's been around for centuries known as Stoicism. And Marcus Aurelius is a name most associated with Stoicism. Dr. Spock is another, right? Buddhist philosophy is in many ways harkens to the idea of Stoicism. What is Stoicism? Stoicism, when you hear that word, oh, he's real Stoic, means he's got a stiff upper lip and he's unflappable and nothing can change him. And that's a decent synonym for what it means to be Stoic. But Stoicism is honest enough to say there is sorrow in this world. There is a place for grief. There is no such thing as a world without grief. Sorrow is unavoidable. But Stoicism would say, though there is sorrow, you must not be swallowed by it. You must not allow your grief to become immoderate. And in that sense, it is not so different from what we understand about Christian joy. True, There is sorrow. There is grief. Paul tells people in 1 Thessalonians 4, we do not want you to grieve as those who have no hope. There's a category for grief as a Christian, but not to be swallowed by it. Stoicism and Christianity share that in common. But what is the aim of Stoicism? What is the satisfaction found in Stoicism? It is this. If everything is passing, including you, then excessive emotion, excessive grief, is really a waste of emotion. It is a failure to embrace the way things are rather than the way you wish things were. But satisfaction in Stoicism, the aim of Stoicism is this, that you would be aligned with reality, with truth. This is the world as it is, and it is best to embrace the world as it is. That's Stoic joy, Stoic anchoring. How is that different from a Christian view of joy? Yes, be in alignment with the truth. Yes, reckon the frailty of your life. Yes, reckon the place for sorrow. But here's the difference. A Stoic joy appeals to an alignment with reality. A Christian joy appeals to an alignment with the fact that's relational, that we belong to a Father who sees us, who made us, who takes joy in us, and who came for us and loves us in spite of all that we are. It's a different kind of joy. It's not alignment with ration or reason. It's alignment with who we are before Him. And that we take from what Jesus says to His disciples here in John chapter 16. It follows this sort of act in three scenes: acclaim, confusion, and then clarification. He throws it out there in verse 16. In a little while, you won't see me. And then in a little while, you'll see me. And take note of that word, a little while. It's the original word, it's from the word we get the word micron. You hear it six times. He's trying to telegraph something to you. A little while. And we have the benefit of knowing how that narrative arc plays out. So we listen to that and we go, yeah, I know what he's talking about. When he says, in a little while you won't see me, he'll be taken, he'll be arrested, he'll be tried, he'll be convicted, and he'll be executed as an attempt to maintain social order among the Roman Empire. And everybody thinks, in that moment, he's done. The story is over. Let's go back to our homes and to our lives. And then they discover that the end is not an end. But in that moment, what do the disciples do? They do what you and I do. Rather than ask the Lord for a lot of stuff, we just sort of talk amongst ourselves. Yeah, we'll figure it out. It's really kind of odd. Like, he says that, and their first instinct is, well, it's just, what do you think he meant? I have no idea. And then once again, they repeat exactly what he said. What does he mean by that? And we listen to that moment and we kind of slap our heads going, why has this not landed? And then if you're honest enough with yourself, you snap your own head going, why has this not landed? They're confused. They're confused about this succinct little claim that Jesus is out to prompt and prepare them for what's about to happen. And so he steps in, it's like, I can see you all are confused. And he offers this little clarification. I'm going to be gone. And you will think the story is over. And then you will discover that it's just begun. But I have come for you, that I will die for you, and then I will be risen again. Two sentences, each with a conjunction, the word but. But two different words for the conjunction. In a little while, you won't see me. In a little while, you will weep and lament, but the world will rejoice. You will think it's all over and all is lost, and the rest of the world is going to think, finally, problem solved. Can we get on with it? And then he says, you will be sorrowful, but your sorrow will turn to joy. The word there in the original language there for the word but is it's an emphatic word. You have no idea the turnabout. It ought to be read this way, as though I tried to read it interpretively in the reading. You will be sorrowful, but your sorrow will turn into joy. I don't know if he raised his voice. But you will be as startled as you will be overjoyed. This is his claim. This is what he's trying to get across to them. This is what he says sort of succinctly and with a certain coyness to it. And then everything changes. In a moment like that, we wonder, what's he getting at? He is there to say, death will not have the last word. So what is this joy that is meant to be the source of ours, the place of anchoring, when the world is not happy? At risk of sounding like Captain Obvious, here it is. Your joy is inextricably bound to the belief that he is alive. And in his aliveness, you are forgiven. And in his forgiveness, you have a future. And in your own death, you have a reason to look forward to what will be new on the other side of it. Do you ever think about that? When you are discouraged, does that ever come into your frame of reference in the moment? This is the joy that's set before them. It is the joy set before us. He uses a very subtle comment, though, in his analogy that he points to, and some commentators sort of note the difference. When he references childbirth, what happens in that moment is that the only way for the mother of the child to experience the joy of the child being brought into her arms and of all things being made new by the birth of that child, the only way to that was through the pain. The only way to experience everything that brings her to tears in that joy and everyone around her who shares in that was for her to go through that sorrow. Times are different before epidurals and Pitocin. But there was no joy apart from that pain, which, as some commentators notice, be clear on what Jesus is saying and why he's invoking that picture to help us understand the joy that is ours. He is not saying sorrow will simply come to an end and joy will take its place. Not that sorrow will be replaced by joy, but that your sorrow will turn into joy. That there will be a transformation of that sorrow into joy, but there is no way to get to that joy unless the sorrow is first transformed. You don't get to bypass it. You do have to walk through it. As if to suggest, as it is in childbirth, so it is the cross. For the joy set before him, the author of Hebrews said, whom we consulted for many months, several months ago, for the joy set before him, he endured the cross, despising its shame. There was no way to that joy apart from the sorrow of his cross. And that is in some ways instructive to us. I'll say it once here, and I'll say it again in just a few moments. If joy is like the roots of a tree, then as George Herbert famously wrote in one of his poems, we are the trees whom shaking fastens more. To that joy, we fall through this sorrow. It's the only way to it. It is why we listen to him and reckon with his. We are more anchored in that joy by being shaken. Which is why he will tell his disciples, what you're about to go through, with what you're about to experience, on the other end of it, the joy that you will have, it can never be taken from you. Something lasts. even in your tears, even through your sorrow. It's the nature of this joy. That's the joy in summary. How do we practice it? That's the last thing I want to talk about. What does it mean to practice this joy? Two things. One word from Jesus, one word from James. He says there towards the end of John chapter 16, "In that day you're going to ask nothing of me. Truly I say to you, whatever you ask of the Father in my name, he will give it to you. Until now you've asked nothing in my name. Ask and you will receive, that your joy may be full." What an audacious claim. One that makes us go, is he sure? They've asked many things of him. A day is coming when they will not be able to ask of him because he will not be among them. But they will be able to ask his Father, who is their Father, and they will be able to ask him on the basis of his work on their behalf, on the basis of their belonging to the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, on the basis of his work. That's what it means to be in his name, to be in his possession, to be in his belonging, to be in his family. And that's why we have every right to approach the throne of grace because of what he has done. This is the gospel. And we may ask many things of him. And then there are some things that we won't have to ask him any longer because it will be confirmed. Here's the question we all ask ourselves. Is there always a reason for hope? And the resurrection says to us in a resounding yes. There is always a reason for hope because he's risen. And so we ask, and we ask boldly. And like Jesus' brother James says, you know, sometimes you don't receive because you don't ask. And sometimes you ask wrongly because you're always trying to spend it on your own passions. You don't ask it according to what I have done and what I have for you. This joy might be even fuller and our anchoring even deeper through our asking of him what we need. I have no explanation for why Netflix made the film, but it came out on Friday night. And but for a few moments in there that I will only... my ears were peeled back. But the new Knives Out, Wake Up Dead Man. I'm not going to ruin anything, I assure you. But you will be astonished that it has been made in a day like ours. But I will borrow one line from that that ruins nothing in terms of the plot. But one character says of another, they got their miracle, not by being cured or fixed, but by having been given the power, the sustaining power, to get up every day and do what they were here to do in spite of the pain. That was their daily bread. That is what I think Jesus is in part speaking of here. We ask of him, and even if the answers that we seek are not the answers that we get, there is something that we may receive from him, and in that our joy may be fuller than what it was on the front end. And that's why we can say what Jesus' brother James says to us, which is, again, one of those most confounding moments and passages in the whole scripture. Brethren, count it all joy when you face various trials. For you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness, and let steadfastness have its full effect, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. That verse is worth its own sermon. I'm going to try to summarize it in just a few words. He is not saying, when the world falls apart, quick, feel joyful. Because that would be a definition more of like, quick, feel happy. It's not what he's saying. Consider it joy. Meaning this. Consider in the occasion of the things that have brought you to your knees, where you were stultified by your own sorrow and the heartbreak, whether it's sudden over a long period of suffering. Consider that, my friends, an occasion for joy in this sense. Because in that circumstance, you are afforded something that the sunny days will never allow. You are afforded an opportunity of discovery. A discovery of something greater than even all that you've lost. Kids, if I were to go up the row and bring a microphone and just ask you the question. What's the greatest thing that could ever happen to you and the greatest thing that you could ever have? And I would bet a variety of those answers would either have something to do with stuff or an experience or honor. I know one person would say a Tesla and a 1v1 clinic with Kyrie Irving. That would be the greatest thing that could ever happen. When your world suffers, and suffering is defined as desires and dreams denied, when that happens to you, you are thrown back inevitably and unavoidably on this question: what is the greatest thing that could ever be true for you or ever happen to you? And James is telling us this. The greatest thing that can ever happen to you is that you would know the Lord and become like him. That is at the highest, most valuable thing that could ever be true for you. A carefree life, as desirous and appealing as that may sound, is in fact not the greatest life you can ever have. The greatest thing of greatest value you could ever have would be to know the Lord and know that he knows you and be in communion with him and know that he knows you and loves you anyway, in spite of you, and then to become like him. Because what James is pointing to is this: the character that you might have in him. We sang it in the song. We read it in the affirmation. He drew near to us that we might become like him. That's the greatest thing you could ever have. And a lot of you don't believe that right now, and I understand it. I get it. Many days I go, is it really? It is the greatest thing. And it is only through the occasion of suffering that you might inch a little closer in that direction. It's not a guarantee. Some of us go through suffering and we become worse. We become more bitter. But if the Lord is the Lord of heaven and earth, and if he is in fact resurrected, then there is an opportunity for you to have joy in the fact that through this suffering, something on the other side of it, there's something for us in it. What is that joy look like in a very sorrowful moment? I have used this before. I will not apologize for using it again. It is the clearest picture I have of what it means to practice joy in suffering, and it is from a movie, Calvary. She is a French woman vacationing in Ireland with her husband. Her husband is in a car wreck. It's a fatal car crash, and he's on life support and will not survive. And she must now decide to remove life support. And in the wake of that decision, she gathers with the priest in a nearby chapel and has this exchange.
Have you performed the last rites many times?
Yes. Usually with older people, of course. It's time to prepare for it. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows what's coming.
It is easier.
It's never easy. More understandable, let's say. Less unfair situations like this one. People are shocked. The randomness of it. They curse God. They curse their fellow man. They lose their faith in some cases.
They lose their faith. It must not have been much of a faith to begin with, if it is so easy for them to lose it.
Yes, but what is faith? For most people, it's the fear of death. Nothing more than that. If that's all it is, it's very easy to lose. He was a good man. Your husband?
Yes. He was a good man. We had a very good life together. We loved each other very much. And now, he has gone. And that is not unfair. That is just what happened. don't live good lives. They don't feel love. That is what is unfair. I feel sorry for them.
Will you say a prayer with me, Teresa?
My suggestion to you is that is joy in practice. In just a few moments, you see humility. Do you see gratitude? You see perspective. And you see an openness, a receptivity to what good might come from the Lord, even in that, alongside someone else who is attuned to that same desire and hope. We practice joy in these ways. When you weep your tears, pray them also. And if all you can do is stutter in them, stutter. When your mind is filled with everything that you've lost, inevitably, we practice joy by making a little space in our minds as best we can for the joy that was set before me, endured the cross, despising the shame. That you situate yourself among those who are also attuned to that joy and those words, to the context to which both James and Jesus are speaking. And you see all that you've lost against what is of greatest value in this world. Not that it might dry up your tears, but it might help you to see them differently.